Rensselaer to the world. This is RSVP, Rensselaer's award-winning distributed education program.
Okay, welcome back. This is the second lecture. So we will continue from where we left off in terms of the introduction to telephony, cable, and internet technologies. So we were talking about switching, specifically telephone switching, which is one of the key pieces. The other piece is to refresh your memory where end systems, transmission equipment, switches, and you had signaling capabilities. Okay, so the I said one of the key ideas of a switch was to connect its inputs to its outputs, and then so since each user could call any other user, okay, one of the key ideas in switching is that you wouldn't have permanent circuits between any user and any other user. In other words, you would just have an on-demand or a temporary circuit between a user and another user. In other words, users could multiplex the switch itself over time. Okay, if you think of the switch as a network resource, that itself is being shared over time. Okay, the other network resources are links like fiber optics or the local loop and so on. The local loop, for example, you have a separate local loop to every home, so you're not sharing that with anybody else. But later we'll see that that same local loop is shared between telephone and then DSL service and so on. Okay, but so the local loop is not shared, okay, whereas the switching is shared, okay, over time. So this is known as on-demand switching or on-demand circuit setup or temporary circuits, okay. And similarly, the lines are shared. Once you have a call, the call is not shared between anybody else, okay. So the call, you are guaranteed resources within the call, but you share over time. Because, I mean, this is natural because you don't call all the time, right? So there is a lot of idle period between when you call and when you don't. Okay, so the switches come today in two parts. As I said, the earlier switches had both of these parts integrated, the switch fabric itself and the switch controller, excuse me. And what coordinates these two is the signaling aspect. Okay, so there's a signaling call that comes from and traverses multiple switches and coordinates the setup of the control elements. And then the control elements in turn coordinate how the cross-point matrix is set up and so on, how the switching matrix is set up. So the switch, basic function of the switch is transfers data or voice information or signals from input to output, and it has many ports. Okay, so you can have 200,000 plus simultaneous calls. Okay, and this was several years back, and then it's the density of switches has been growing over time, right? So you need higher speeds and denser, interfaces. You need lots of interfaces on the switches, especially in the core switches. So within a switch, you have lots of interfaces, and then, say, suppose you have, say, 1,000 interfaces, and you can have calls coming from any port to any other port. Okay, so you have 1,000 times 1,000 types of possibilities. So instead of connecting every port to every other port, you have other types of architectures, because interconnecting ports to ports is a costly resource. So you connect it on demand, okay? So the way you connect it on demand, the simplest way is known as space division switching, or also called crossbar switching. So the canonical way to think about it is to have inputs coming this way and outputs going this way. This is just a modeling way of looking at it. whenever an input is connected to an output, that cross point is turned on, or they are connected together, right? So it turned out later that you cannot connect any input to any other output at all times. So the cross points became a scarce resource. Okay, and if you know economics 101, anything that's scarce is shared, right? So anything that's scarce is costly. I mean, you pay a lot of money for it, and you try a lot to share it or manage it and so on. Whenever you hear manage, you mean something is better be costly. There's no point managing it. Rather get away by not managing it. So similarly, you want to control these cross points and the setup of these cross points. So that's why you have a switch controller. And the essential thing that a switch controller does is it sets up a schedule of which cross points are going to be on when. Okay. And there are other fairly complex schemes on how to set up these cross points, and there are multi-stage cross points, etc. Okay. So we shall study switching as a topic in itself later in this class in great detail, okay, and understand what it takes to scale these switches, be able to build larger switches, etc. So if you look at just another example of crossbar switching elements, this is an example of an electromechanical switch. It was not an electronic switch, but an electromechanical switch where these had crossbar capabilities. So another way of switching is you switch over time. Okay. In other words, if you are able to turn off the crossbar fast, right, you can, when the voice sample is coming, so within the same time slot, you're able to set up one crossbar and quickly go to another crossbar and so on and so forth. You can set up multiple crossbars within a given time slot. Okay, so that is one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is you have a fast server that can take information or signals from one port and send it to another port and service multiple ports within a single time slot, right? So in other words, each input port gets served over time slots, and within the time slot, you are sharing this costly resource, which is the server, and then the focus is on making the server extremely fast and flexible, etc., right? So this is sometimes known as a time slot interchanger, less fancily, it's called a time division switch. Okay, just like you have time division multiplexing on a transmission link, you have a time division switching element, which does the switching function. Okay, so in larger switches, the simplest principle is we combine time-based switching as well as space-based switching. That's one simple way of thinking about it. Okay, so we'll study this in more greater detail. That's an overview of switching. Then moving on to the signaling. So what is signaling? So whenever we refer to signaling, it's like, I lift my telephone and then make a call, and I'm magically connected to the other end, and we start talking. Okay, so this process of actually setting up this call and everything in between, right? So as soon as you pick up your phone, there's an off-hook, there's a small signal which goes to the central office saying, this guy's actually picked up his phone, right? So all these minor things along with the overall coordination function of setting up the call and the resources for the call, so that once the call is set up, it doesn't get dropped all the time. Okay, so that is known as signaling function. So signaling function can be thought of as a conversation starting from your telephone, going to the first switching control element, going to the other switching control element, and in each step you admit the call or set up resources. And as you go from one switching element to the other switching element, you also route that signaling call. Because you might have the direct connection might not be available, you have to go through an indirect connection. So routing is a function in internet that is actually decoupled from signaling. Okay, but in the telephony, both of these are coupled in the sense that when a signaling call goes through, you also invoke a routing function and admission control function and so on, set up the resources, and then route the signaling call. It goes through the network to the other side, and then you get an acknowledgement saying that the whole thing has been done reliably. Okay, later when we study quality of service, one of the big things we'll study is that these multiple functions are all decoupled. So signaling will be decoupled from routing, and then you have end-to-end quality of service being decoupled from network quality of service and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is just a quick sort of look into the future. So the switch controller was initially in hardware, and it was integrated along with the switch matrix. Then it became a separate component, and then with the electronic switching and stored program control, it became flexible. You started having new features on your telephone. You could have call forwarding capabilities. You can have three-way calling. You can have prepaid calling, and so on and so forth, right? So all these new features are essentially implemented primarily through on the switching program control side, okay, whereas the telephone remained dumb as ever. Okay, so this is an example of an intelligent network, okay, and a dumb end system. Okay, the reason I emphasize this so much is because the internet is exactly the opposite. And it came out because of the technology development. The computer started becoming cheaper and cheaper, so it became economical to have an intelligent end system. Okay, then you ask, if the end system is intelligent, why do we need to put intelligence in network? So that is a logical conclusion to that was what is famously known as the end-to-end principle. So the end-to-end principle says push the intelligence out to the ends and have basic functions provided by the network. Okay, but we shall argue as we go forward, and if you want different abstractions of connectivity, you need to put more functions inside the network, and then continuing architectural debate in the networks, in the internet, is about where to put this function, how much performance you really need, what are the abstractions you really need, and so on. Okay, so if you look at cutting-edge research, that's what is going on. Okay, so it manages the network. You get all these sort of call routing, alarms, billing, and all these other things. You also have directory lookup services, which is essentially a simple way to think about is your 800 number calling and so on. So the way signaling is structured is that it actually runs on a separate network of its own. So if you think of these blocks, which are the control elements of switches, those are connected directly to other adjacent control elements of other switches, and they form their own data network. Okay, in other words, there's a separate channel, okay, and this is also called a common signaling channel, or CCS, common control signaling, okay, common channel signaling, sorry. And on top of this channel, you send signaling messages, which are signaling packets, which go from switch to switch. And this network, which is made of switches, which not only send packets to each other through this common channel, and the switches themselves are intelligent, is sometimes also referred to as the intelligent network. So there's actually intelligent network is a formal term in telephony, which refers to the switching network or the switch control network. Okay. And the protocol or the sort of format of messages and the way these messages are exchanged between pairs of switches is also called a signaling system. And one of the famous signaling systems which is in existence today is called SS7 or signaling system 7. Okay. So that's a quick bird's eye view. Okay, so that is the CCS or CCIS refers to this overlay network, which operates on the same physical facilities but uses different bands, etc., and forms a separate network. Okay, another way, another thing you can immediately realize is the internet itself was an overlay network on top of telephony. Now the internet is an overlay network on top of almost everything. You can run internet on top of wireless. It can run it on top of cable networks and so on. Okay, and then the overlay network is becoming the real network over time, right? So that is the story we're going to talk about. But so here is the first example of an overlay network where you're overlaying or you have this new network, which is a logical network that is actually mapped to physical network in some particular way. In this particular case, the way you map it is you assign a separate channel to it. That's why it's called a common channel. Common channel signaling. Okay, so the alternative type of signaling network was to have what is known as in-band signaling. That is, within the voice frequencies itself, within the 3.4 kilohertz itself, you used to send signaling tones, etc. Okay, and it turns out that that was very vulnerable to hackers, and people could actually steal telephone calls by faking those signals. Okay, so they actually made this channel completely separate, so that they can have control over it. And then there was also other performance reasons why they did it. You did not have interference between these channels, between signaling calls, signaling messages and the actual voice conversations. Okay. So the way signaling works is it just has a simple state diagram. I mean, when you get a pick up a phone, there's an off-hook signal or a dial tone which goes to the central office. Okay, and then the central office sets up, your dial tone. Okay, it gives you the saying, okay, now you're ready to dial. And then you dial the numbers, and then you collect all the digits. Earlier systems, you should just, as you dial one by one, it will automatically set up the things. Now you collect all the digits at once. Now you know where you want to send the telephone call to. And then you run a setup message that goes from one switch to the other. It gets routed along the way. And at each hop, it reserves the resources, like one voice channel in a TDM multiplexed aggregate. You keep setting all this up. And then when you go to the other side, you also get a confirmation that the whole thing has been set up. Okay, and that's the confirmation is the ringing tone. Okay, you hear the other side ringing. That's the confirmation. And then you start talking, and then you disconnect, and there's a disconnect function. Okay, all this is fairly obvious, okay, but we have this fancy name of a state transition diagram because it's a computer type thing. Right? Any questions so far? Cool, right? So I hope you're not being bored to death. Okay, anyway, so probably this is a little more interesting. Okay, so the one of the implications of the telephony architecture is that routing is very simple. Okay, so as I said, routing is a function that is coupled along with the signaling. Now, the routing essentially leverages the fact that you have a fully connected core. Okay, and you have a simple hierarchy all the way down to the telephone, humble telephone. So the way it works is if you have a phone call that is within the same exchange area, the central office will try to set it up directly within the same central office or within the network of central offices. Typically, the central offices are logically connected to each other, but it, in practice, there is another level of switching if it's too uneconomical to set up connections between every pair of central offices. And these special switches are called tandem switches. Okay, and but essentially, you can think of central offices being connected to each other within the same area, and you quickly set up a circuit within the central office, or you forward the call all the way to the core network. And in the core network, you have a direct connection to the other side of the country or wherever you want to go. And if you don't have if the direct link is unavailable, in other words, if it's congested, if it has too many calls on it already, you find an alternate path which is two hops long. Okay, so this is about, this is a simplified form of telephony routing, and that's about it. Okay, then there are obviously other optimizations related to time of day and so on, which have come on in modern times. But at the core, or in its very simplest sense, telephone routing is as simple as it gets. Here is a large worldwide network that employs trivial routing. Whereas if you compare this to the internet technology, you'll have fairly complex routing, which is highly unstable, and people complain about it all the time. Okay, but there's a reason why the routing has become so complex and why people still live with it, right? So because it is possible to have highly autonomous control of routing, and then you can build simple networks, cheaper networks out of it. Okay, the telephone network, on the other hand, evolved over a longer period of time over the last 100 years, and then it took on a higher cost structure, and that was enabled by a monopoly of these telephone companies or the PT&T of the countries. And then it sort of one part subsidized the other, the local access subsidized the long distance or vice versa and so on. Okay? So to give you an example, AT&T has about 135 or so core switches. If you want to connect all of them together, you will quickly, your calculation comes to around 5 million circuits. So you need to have lots of interconnections between them. Okay. Okay. So the telephony routing algorithm, as I said, is extremely simple. It can be summarized in one page. Okay. If you look at my internet protocol slides, I have like three whole lectures spanning like five classes on just on routing. Okay. So it's basically what I just talked about. Within the same exchange area, you go from CO to CO. CO stands for central office or end office. And otherwise, you just drop the call to the core or the toll switches. And these toll switches have direct interconnectivity. You use a one-hop path or a two-hop path. So it's almost a static routing problem. Okay, and it's there for good reason, because there was no computers there. So you didn't have the capability to do highly dynamic routing and all that. Or even human operators just needed a quick lookup chart, and when a call came, you needed to be able to connect. So static was the best. Okay, so if you want to look at, if you want to abstract out some of these economics and technological aspects and see, take a step back and see what are these characteristics of the telephone network. And as you evolve the telephone networks to integrated services architecture, you want to come towards a common architecture. What are the aspects of the telephone network you need to preserve? There is a notion of resource reservation. So you need to have some notion of resource reservation, that is the 64 kilobit per second or a circuit for you. Okay. So now it's moved from a physical circuit and human operators connecting to a notion of virtual circuit that is provided in the ATM networks. And in between, we also moved towards from a physical single wire to time division multiplexed or frequency division multiplexed components within a single wire. Okay. So these were all the transitions which the telephone technology made. But ultimately, you still have the notion of resource reservation. Okay? And the telephone network as it stands today, you have resource reservation that is coupled with signaling, with routing. Okay? So, and the routing part is simple. So when you go into data networks, we'll see that the path reservation or routing itself, path discovery itself, is a decoupled aspect. And then resource or path reservations are thought of as separate problems, decoupled problems. And the other aspect is that once you have the voice, it turns out, luckily, the voice was very predictable and stable in terms of what it wanted. It did not want too much. It just wanted 64 kilobit per second. And you engineer the network for voice, okay, whether in the analog domain or in the digital domain. And the application is very stable, unlike internet applications, which can grow or shrink at a moment's notice. Okay, it's very bursty. That's what internet applications are. Okay, and if you look at the technology and economic aspects, it's also to some extent historical, because all the intelligence was put in the switch side, and you wanted to support economies of scale through switching. These switches had to become extremely reliable, because they were shared, and the phone side things were very dumb. Okay, the phone systems were very dumb, and it's not uncommon to see switches, even the worst switches, having downtime just a few minutes per year. Okay, in the telephone networks lingo, it is called five nines terminology, or 99.999% reliable, which means you'll probably expect 5 minutes downtime per year, or the mean time between failures, which is another measure of fault tolerance, is very high. Okay, so and the source itself can learn of the topology. When we say the source, it's the center of a switch, which can quickly learn of the topology and figure out where to forward the call. And then once you're in the toll network, the source knows about the entire topology, and it can quickly compute the routes. Okay, there's no fancy routing algorithm there. And the only hitch in the routing is that you have to do, it's coupled with resource reservation. So if the resource is not available, you have to find alternate routes. Okay, otherwise routing would have been even more trivial in telephone networks. Okay, so the topology, if you look at topology and ask how's the topology, topology is very simple. It's hierarchical for scale, and the core is fully meshed for simplicity in routing. Okay, these are the characteristics you get. But what is the price of this, of the simplicity? The cost of the core is very high. Okay, switches have to be extremely dense, and over time switches have become have responded to this challenge, and highly dense switches have evolved out of that. And in terms of organizational aspects, a single organization controls the entire network, or it used to control the entire networks, and now the control of that of the organization has been limited. It controls either the core of the network, like the long distance providers of today, which are called inter-exchange carriers, or if you'll hear this lingo of IXCs, that's an inter-exchange carrier. And a single organization, at least today, even controls the entire core, even though it has to compete between other cores. Okay, and so at least in the earlier days, you had control of the entire network, you had control of the standards organization, and even Lucent, which is today, it's a separate organization which builds the equipment, was actually part of AT&T, even though there were some other competing providers. So it was highly what is known as a vertically integrated enterprise, and therefore you could afford to standardize, you could afford to make these changes, and you could afford this high cost structure because of the monopoly structure. Okay, so this is very important as we start studying internet, and you'll realize that internet is completely the opposite of this. Okay, the topology is very complex. It's not hierarchy. It's some bit mesh topology and so on and so forth. Routing is complex. It's unstable. The components themselves are unstable. Routers go down more often than switches, even the best ones. Okay, and the worst ones don't even think about it. They keep going down all the time. compared to switches, and therefore it's compensated by the intelligence in the routing and the decentralized nature of routing. And in terms of organizational aspects, you have autonomous systems in the internet. It's a highly decentralized and highly fragmented nature of the internet, that there are lots of autonomous systems. I mean, if you look at the AS number allocation in the internet, which is a proxy for asking how many autonomous systems, AS stands for autonomous system, there are over 12,000 or 13,000 autonomous systems right now, and that was actually growing very fast during the boom time, because every dot-com was getting its own AS number, and now it is stabilized and it's actually coming down slightly. So, so to put it quickly, the routing in terms of its nature is source-based. In other words, the source or the edge switch, as sometimes you call that the source, can figure out the entire route and articulates the entire route, and that is actually signaled. And the signaling call goes from follows the source route, and it goes and sets up resources for the call. And the overall routing scheme itself is very simple. It's an alternate path routing. You have a single hop. If that's not available, find an alternate path. And that's a simple table lookup. It's as simple as it gets. Okay, so routing is fairly simple. Okay, you can't get anything any simpler than telephony routing. Okay, so another aspect of what I call techno-economics, in some sense, which is useful to understand, because, all these technologies didn't come from magic. Okay, they were driven by all these forces, external forces, is regulation. Okay, so as I mentioned, different countries had different ways of telephone evolution. Most of them had a state-owned or a government-owned telephone company. And in the United States, it was a private company, the AT&T. And there were other independent companies, but they were sort of bit players who were covering local areas. But the entire core was done by AT&T. And in the early 1900s, the Bell Telephone Company basically bought up a lot of independence in exchange for some concessions, and it quickly built up a monopoly. And then after people did the Sherman Act and so on in early 1930s or so on, people figured out this is a monopoly, it's a harm to society, so they need to have to regulate it. So ever since the 1930s, AT&T has been a regulated monopoly. And as the evolution of technology has happened, the pressure on monopoly technology breakthroughs like the computer, the transistor and so on, switching technologies, fiber optics and so on, and even the PBX technologies at the end system side has driven deregulation to some extent. So first things that were deregulated were the end systems, because the interfaces were standardized. So the end systems could be deregulated, which means that the enterprises could own their own telephones, for example. Today you go and buy telephones from Best Buy, right? Earlier you couldn't buy it from Best Buy. You had to buy it only from AT&T. In fact, you had to lease a telephone. Today, for a cable network, you lease your set-top box. You don't, and to some extent, you're buying your cable modem, but you're still leasing these things. Okay, so that's an example of a control. You don't own the end system, right? So today you own the end systems. And then later, what happened was that MCI and such players emerged in the long-distance market, and it was slowly considered feasible to do competition in the long-distance market. Okay, so then in 1984, breakup was a major change. Okay, but before we get into that, I think one of the most important concepts in telephone regulation is the notion of common carrier. Okay, this is a concept you come again and again. Okay, so the key idea of common carrier was a deal that was struck between regulators and the telephone company, was that the telephone company will provide you a circuit or a pipe or a conduit from end to end, and that's all. It will not control the content on that conduit. Okay, now this implications of this is very high. Okay, if it were to control the content on that conduit, right, what would have happened is today fax would have taken longer time to emerge, or even the internet itself would have taken a longer time to emerge, because that would have been predicated upon the rate at which AT&T decided to innovate, right? So because the content was not regulated, end users could come up with their own content, right? So primarily it was a privacy issue, because if I talk, I don't want you to regulate what I talk, right? So so content was considered to be initially wise, but later people figured out that you can actually send fax through the telephone lines, and then you can send voice band modems and essentially data communications to telephone lines and so on. So the common carrier concept to some extent can be said to have fueled the boom of fax, fueled the boom of the internet to some extent. Okay, and so that's the key thing. So this is called a separation of content from conduit. Okay, so the reason I make up all these words is whenever you read business literature, you keep seeing all these words, and I mean I was actually naive when I was initially. I mean, what is all this? Everything means the same thing to me, right? So once you realize it is a fundamentally regulatory problem. Okay, so regulatory issue. Concept. So to give you a stark difference between this and something else, if you think of the cable TV network, right? Cable TV provides a conduit or a pipe to your home, right? But then it allows you to watch only a packaged or a defined packaged of telephone or TV services. I mean, so suppose you want to watch your own independent channel, right? See, for example, we have favorite programs in India which we watch. Okay, my wife wants to watch, say, Sun TV. It's a India TV channel. Okay, I can't watch it on my cable. I mean, now I can watch it because they are providing some degree of choice in terms of what I can watch. But essentially, the basic service is offered by cable, and due to regulation, they offer a package of other, advanced, whatever they call it, a bundle of services, right? Like CNN is an example of an independent provider who comes to your home, but it's part of a cable package. So, but the very fact that the cable can package what they offer you and charge for that package in a discriminatory manner, okay, it means that they control the content as well as the conduit. Okay, maybe they don't prepare the content, they get it from independents and so on, but they still control the packaging of it, marketing of it. Okay, so that is an example of something that is not a common carrier. So in fact, some of the regulatory discussions at this point are, some of the people are trying to say, now cable, when you offer cable internet and so on, you should view the cable channel itself as a common carrier. So they're trying to make cable go through a common carrier type regulatory change. Though it's not been very successful, at least so far. Okay, I'm not fully sure of all the reasons, but they still have. It's primarily history, and we'll talk about it when we come to cable side of things. Okay, so we saw this there were local monopolies in this old global monopoly of AT&T, and then you had regulators, and slowly through the FCC. FCC basically stands for Federal Communications Commission. I never don't even know the thing. FCC is what regulates the long distance portion or state to state portion of the telephone infrastructure. The within the state, suppose you make a call within New York State, right? It's and the regulation of that is done by what is known as state commissions or state communication commissions. And local bodies like the municipality has pretty much no say. Whereas in the cable regulation framework, local authorities have some say over cable regulation. Anyway, so that's just a FYI. So over time, regulation has been driven by technology changes, and the terminal equipment was deregulated first, and then you had the what is famously called the modified final judgment. Okay, don't ask me why it was called that. It's just a breakup of the entire AT&T company into two parts. One part which was deemed to be competitive, like the long distance part. But even then, the long-distance unit of AT&T was regulated all the way through 1995. So only in 1995 were full price regulations taken out of AT&T. Till that time, and the competitors were considered to be in need of regulation. So by 1995, AT&T had already dropped to 50% market share or below that. So now it's precipitously dropping. Okay, so regulation has been coming, has been with us all the time. So probably a more recent regulatory phenomenon has been what is known as the Telecom Act of 1996, which attempted to do the following. I mean, it said that, okay, now we have deregulated the core network. Now let's try to deregulate the local access network and have competition in the last mile, so to speak, okay, through competitive local exchange providers who would come and compete. And also these long distance providers themselves could come and offer you local service. Okay, now if you have your long distance provider, it is not unusual for you to receive marketing calls like I do from MCI all the time saying, offering me local service in addition to long distance service. Okay, and they give you a bundle and defined bundle and so on. But this process, I think it's best to say that it's been checkered. Okay, so it's had an interesting history from 1996. I don't know whether I want to go into great detail into this. The way the actual mechanisms for allowing competition in the last mile was the recognition that the last mile providers like these Verizon still had a large monopoly, and they were forced through regulation to what is known as unbundle their elements. So if you have the local loop, and if AT&T wanted to provide local service to you, to me as a customer, it would get access to me. Okay, so through regulatory fiat, the long-distance providers could come in and provide access. So there were other smaller players also called competitive local exchange carriers, or CLECs, which started providing, attacking the business market or small business markets and so on. But there's been a lot of wrangling, both in terms of regulation, legal, and so on. So and in addition to that, there were technology problems and market problems and so on. So many of the CLECs have gone out of business. So if some of you remember COVAD and NorthPoint, I mean, congratulations, you remember a CLEC. Okay, so now most of them have been bought up, and so the minimal regulation which exists today, minimal competition which exists today is through what is known as UNEP. Okay, I don't know why there are so many. So these are known as unbundled network elements. That's what this UNE stands for. And I myself don't know what this P is for. Okay, so essentially you have local providers providing access to local loops to competitors at a regulated price. Okay, and AT&T's and MCI's of the world are coming in and providing a service through that, and so on. Okay, and then once these conditions have been satisfied, the ILECs, or the incumbent local exchange carriers, are allowed to compete in long distance as well. So it wouldn't be sooner or later Verizon will start coming to you and saying, I'll give you long distance as well in addition to local. So this has already happened in several other states like Florida and Tennessee and so on, where Bell South operates. It has already satisfied the conditions for offering long distance, but in some other states it's still undergoing wrangling. Okay, but at the end of the day, what has happened is that ILEC still retain 90% of the local market. Okay, and later we'll look at some interesting phenomena like wireless is starting to substitute local lines and so on. But still, Verizon also owns a wireless unit. So they are still trying to keep their options open and all these things. Okay, so that's a quick look at how the regulation landscape has played out. It's very interesting to see how these affect the technology growth curves and the booms and the busts of the era, right? So today's U.S. network looks like this. You have a local area, okay, which is obviously given an acronym. It's called LATA, okay? I think it's called Local Access Transport Access. I don't know what it is. I mean, so it's called LATA, okay? And you have the central offices, as we talked about earlier, operated by the local Bell company in these LATAs. And then there is one special point, probably a sort of glorified central office called Point of Presence, or POP. Okay? And at this point of presence, this local access company, or LEC, will connect to the long-distance companies. Okay, the AT&Ts and MCIs of the world connect to the Verizons of the world at these points called POPs. And by regulatory mandate, these access have to be equal access. So the local fellow cannot provide discriminatory access to any of these long-distance providers. So you see these IXEs, or these long-distance networks, which are typically full meshes, which are connected to these local networks through these POPs. And there are some sort of other minor rules regarding how connectivity is established to the POPs and so on. Okay, so this is what it looks like after 1984. Okay, now in addition to this, you have central offices that serve wireless networks, wireless or cellular networks, etc. Okay, but all of that eventually dump the traffic back to either a POP or to a central office, and traffic is pretty much carried on the wired network after that. Okay, and within an exchange area, like within, say, in New York State or within Verizon's network, you would have this kind of this sort of architecture. You have these blobs called end offices, which is the same thing as central offices. These are called central or end because they were central to a locality, right? So, and local loops go out of the central office. So central office is this massive place where all these local loops, like hundreds of thousands of local loops, come and land up at the central office. You have these huge switches and all these termination equipment which terminate all this analog business. And then now they throw it into digital cross connects, blah, 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 and throw it. Okay, so anyway, so that's an end office or a central office. Now, there are multiple central offices in a region. And typically, you would want all these end offices to be connected directly to each other, right? That's the simplest phenomenon, like you put a full mesh. But it would not be economical. Suppose you don't have so many circuits in one end office, which warrants a connection to another end office directly. You go through another office known as a tandem office, or the boxes here are sometimes called tandem switches. And more now it's become more logical. The switches, switching functions are called tandem switching functions, toll switching functions, and I guess the last mile switches and so on. So these could be integrated into single switches. So these are massive integrated switches. So this is similar in some sense to the airline, the way the airline works. You have hubs in big airports, and then instead of having direct connectivity from any point to any other point, you go through these hubs, which is a pain for you because as a traveler, you're forced to go through these multiple delays, right? So it's almost like a telephone call which goes through these multiple hubs, whereas for a traveler, it's even a bigger deal. So that's why you don't cross more than one or two hubs before you get to your destination. Okay, so instead of having a full mesh, okay, or connectivity from everywhere to everywhere. And ultimately, you reach these points of presence, or sometimes also called toll offices, and then it connects to a toll network, which could be one or more. Okay, this is where you get connected to your appropriate long-distance provider. Okay, so that's a quick roundup of telephone networks. Okay, so I'll be happy to field some questions on this before we go on to cable stuff. Any questions? Okay, I can conclude two things. Either you understand everything or you understand nothing, right? So what I'll do is probably, I mean, if it's hard for you to formulate questions, at the end of every slide set, I'll probably create sort of informal quiz type of thing. I've not done it for this slide set, but I'll do it from next class. I'll give you a quiz. I mean, so when you do the quizzes and look at the answers, it'll give you a mental flash bulb. Okay, so it'll flash up, and if it's wrong, you probably don't know what it's talking about. So you should read up. Okay, so that's what I'll do. Okay, so without no questions. Okay, then we'll move on to cable TV networks. Okay, so this is again a quick overview of how this whole thing works. Okay, and the reason we are looking at it again to recap is that all these three things are coming together in this integrated network or converged network vision for the future. Okay, so cable TV has a very different notion of connectivity than what we have studied earlier. In a telephone, we are talking a peer-to-peer conversation and so on. So there are always two parties who are trying to talk to each other, and there's bidirectional transmission. Whereas in the cable TV network, you have these pre-prepared content or television channels or movie channels, HBO, etc., and it is broadcast to all the cable subscribers. And the cable subscribers just choose appropriate channels, right, as we call it, and to watch the appropriate programs. So at the same time, everybody gets the same channel, if you look at a particular frequency band, right? So this is a broadcast network. So the form of connectivity does not offer interaction. Okay, it is a one-way connectivity. It's not a full duplex connectivity. That's one very important aspect. So it's more of a one-way distribution network. So the reason the cable network is the way it is a distribution network. It's not necessarily a network that allows two-way communication or interactive things. Okay, but now there's more interactivity available through the cable channels, through interactive TV and video on demand. Cable video on demand is starting to get rolled out in several areas, and so on and so forth. So, and of course, now we have cable modem as a phenomenon, which is starting to offer internet connectivity, which is essentially a two-way connectivity. But the key thing you have to remember is that the cable's history was to supplement over-the-air broadcast network. So at one point of time, you had the TV came to the Earth, and then everybody wanted to watch TV, and there were three channels. Okay, so like ABC, NBC, and so on. These were the broadcast channels. Okay, and then it turned out that not everybody could get access to this. To this TV or broadcast resource. The signals were weak in several communities. So what happened was cable TV started out actually as CATV or community antenna TV. Okay, so what essentially you would have is you could pick up the channels by either microwave or satellite or some very strong powerful receiver, and then you would distribute it locally. Okay, the way you would distribute locally was to actually string it through some local wires. So the cable net TV providers actually ran wires through the community. And these wires at that point of time in the 60s turned out to be coaxial cable because they didn't want to use twisted pair. The reason was the twisted pair was a small bandwidth. It just provided 3.4 kilohertz, not useful for TV, which requires about 6 megahertz for every channel. So you need lots of channels, which means you need a different transmission modality. So coax cable was set up, and then you had this network, distribution network, or a tree sort of network, which was built out. Okay, so that's the history, okay? So cable TV itself didn't start off as a monopoly, but slowly it's grown into something that people really want. I mean, everybody's hooked onto the TVs. That's why we have cable, right? In my house, we don't. Okay, so because I'm hooked onto the internet, I'm hooked onto the cable service just because I have cable modem. But we still have only basic service. So since the consumers really wanted that, it was economical over time to relay cables all the way to the home. And cable TV as an industry itself thrived in a more looser regulatory environment compared to telephony. Okay, telephony was also already this big behemoth, and which had to be regulated. And cable TV was the small players who were trying to provide this valuable service to customers in communities, right? So there were these sort of big players. You don't regulate these people, right? So there, over time, they had control of the conduit and content. So they could package the content and conduit and charge premium rates, etc., and allowed them to grow economically. And now they've sort of merged organizationally and so on and so forth. Now they become big, right? And now they're starting to provide internet. And now the telephone companies are worried. Okay, now so you have competition through between DSL and cable modem, etc. So that's what's happening nowadays. Okay, so cable. Coax cable was chosen because of its higher bandwidth. In some sense, you can think of this as broadband, but it's all analog channels. It's one-way channel. There's nothing interactivity about it, and it's broadcast channel. Okay, it's not a point-to-point network. So that's why we call it as a distribution network, and it's RF technology. It's not fiber. Okay, so its attributes are it's broadcast. And there was some band left aside for reverse traffic, okay, but the amount of bandwidth you should see is not too great. Okay, but it's still substantial. It's good enough to run cable modems at substantial speeds. So mainly one-way video channels, and it's a reasonably secure network because you use scrambling technologies and make sure people don't steal cable servers, etc. And you have a private conduit to the home, right? Other SIG. And it's since coax cable is a much more electromagnetically better medium, it is free from other interference, whereas twisted pair is still susceptible to more interference. And it has a tremendous bandwidth. Okay, so cable is indeed broadband. Okay, but what we're doing with it is to watch TV. Okay, we are in some sense wasting this broadband. Instead of doing internet, we're watching TV on it, right? So that's what we're paying for. Internet, nobody pays, right? So it has, today's cable, even the ones which have been there for the last 40 years, have over 1 gigahertz of bandwidth. Okay, and it has even more than 1 gigahertz, but practically, about 550 megahertz is used, and then 750 megahertz are used in the newer versions of the newer plans of cable. And it's fairly flexible. I mean, you can change equipment at the end systems, primarily the cable boxes you have at home, as well as the set-top boxes, as well as the cable infrastructure at what is known as the head end, or you can think of this as a central office. And you can have new features. That's why when people offer you, when the cable company offers you digital TV, right, he says, give me back your set-top box, I'll give you a new one, right? So he leases a set-top box. So he's basically has a setup where you get new technology and you're able to manage this channel intelligently. Okay, so just like in the twisted pair, as you go towards higher and higher frequencies, the attenuation increases with frequency bands. So if you want to carry a wide spectrum of frequencies or a wide band of frequencies or a broad band of frequencies, to offer, say, several channels, like tens of channels, you will have to have amplification periodically. Okay, so the cable plant looks something like this. Where is it? Yeah. So the cable plant looks something like this. You have either some sort of a satellite receiver, etc., to pick up the channels or the private channels, and then it drops it at this RF head end, and you have this coaxial cable, and you have these small triangles here, which are just the amplifiers. Now, these amplifiers are also called active elements. Okay, the active versus passive element. Passive element doesn't need power. Okay, it's an unpowered element, whereas an active element needs power. Okay, if you think of the telephone, it's a passive element, telephone at the home, whereas these amplifiers are active elements because they need to be offered power, and this makes it a little more complex, costly, etc. Okay, so you have about more than 40 plus amplifiers before it reaches your home. Okay, and you need this because otherwise you won't get this broad band. Okay, and so on. Okay, so this is the basic architecture. You see, it looks like a tree, which is suitable for a broadcast medium. Okay, so let's come back here. If you look at the building blocks, instead of using twisted pair, it uses this coax cable, and this coax cable looks like this. It has internally there's a cable, and there are sheets, and then and so on and so forth. Okay, I won't get into a lot of details, but it's essentially to protect against electromagnetic interference and give you a wider band in which you can do fancy things. Okay, and in terms of the head end equipment, which is another building block, you have interesting filters. Okay, which is known as a diplex filter. That allows you to have a reverse, it allows you to have some amount of full duplex behavior. You can have some reverse channels coming back, which are under 40 megahertz. And above, this small guard band here, and then you have 54 through 750 megahertz, is all the channels that are being dumped at you. Okay. So, and in this forward carriers, you have essentially frequency bands here, and the cable TV head end has flexibility in putting content on those bands. Okay, and each band is 6 megahertz. So you can sort of compute how many bands there are, right? So you have about 700 megahertz here, and you have 6 megahertz per band. So it's about some around 100 channels or so you can put in. Okay, so you see the way, if you look at the spectrum as a straight line and you see these areas as usage of cable channels, you see these channels are sitting around here, and you have about 80 analog TV channels which are sitting in the 500 megahertz band. So, and it's been allocated to some extent based upon regulation. You need to provide the basic service, and you want to provide FM service, etc. And then there are some independent channels like CNN, which are provided by regulatory mandate. And now, when you're talking about digital TV, essentially what has happened is that the cable guy has upgraded his equipment all the way up to your end system to be able to actually leverage this band above 550 megahertz. Primarily up to 750 megahertz. Okay, and then here he offers digital services. In these bands, they use digital modulation, etc., and digital transmission compression technology like MPEG and so on and so forth. And then you have these highly capable devices on your end system which can decompress, etc., and offer digital services. And as part of those digital services, you also have movie on demand. So video on demand is being offered through these channels. Okay, so indeed, you can get some movies on demand in different parts of even Time Warner coverage. So that's becoming video on demand has been a big thing for a long time in network and, in fact, video research. Only now it's starting to become a reality, at least starting from the cable side. And within 5 years or 10 years, you'll start seeing it. You can get movies over the internet. Today, I go to Netflix and get my DVDs, and hopefully when I've gone home, I'll have my DVDs to watch today. But instead of getting DVDs over the net, you can get... you can have this instant gratification thing. As soon as you click, you get the movie, right? So so that's where the technology is going. So in terms of the architecture, you have the signal processing center, which is called the head end, which is just dumping all the signals appropriately and filtering everything. And you saw this diplex filter, which is allowing both the forward and reverse operation. As you can imagine, these are fairly complex pieces of equipment, which is sitting at the head end. All the cost is at the head end. You have an economies of scale, which is serving a large community around it. And you have a very simple tree and branch architecture, no fancy full mesh or there's no other architectures like in the internet. You have fairly interesting topologies, nothing like that in the cable. It's a simple tree. So it's obviously the tree is well suited for one-way broadcast, and that's what it was designed for. Okay. And even though cable modem is being rolled out, the architecture still remains a tree. It's just that the fiber is coming closer and closer to your home. Okay. Okay, now one problem with the tree is that it accumulates a lot of things. I mean, first of all, there's attenuation. That's why you put a lot of amplifiers. Now, once you put the amplifiers are noisy. Okay, I mean, they add noise, they add other forms of distortions, and so these distortions add up. Okay, that's why you can't have a cable. Just because you amplify, you can't go infinite distance. Okay, so there is a finite distance to which you can go because of the noise the active amplifiers add. And all these noise and distortions affect plant reliability, because if you have an active element or a powered source, it is more unreliable compared to an unpowered source. Like the telephone is far more reliable than an active amplifier. Okay, so this, I mean, you have to build more, you have to put a lot more cost to get the whole thing reliable. So the plant is more costly, and there are limits on the number of amplifiers which can be cascaded, and there are limits on the bandwidth of operation. Even though the raw cable itself can offer more than, say, let's say, for argument's sake, about 2 gigahertz of bandwidth, unfortunately, you can't get all of that. I mean, because of the number of amplifiers you can put, I mean, the noise and so on and so forth, the bands are limited, and typically today you get about 750 megahertz at max, okay, the deployed systems. But people are starting to look at pushing it to 1 gigahertz, slightly above that, and using very fancy digital signal processing techniques and highly efficient modulation techniques to pack more bits per hertz, I mean, more bits of digital information per analog hertz, right, which is the unit of analog bandwidth. And therefore, you're getting more and more out of the cable plant, both by expanding the band, making it more broadband, making it more interactive, and using complex digital signal processing technology and pushing fiber close. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, all broadband is all about this. See, there's a very simple notion in networking. If you have a smaller wire, you can get more bandwidth out of it, even if the wire itself is lousy. So if you look at the way Ethernet has progressed, Ethernet was thought that you can only get 2 megabits out of it. Then they came 10 megabit Ethernet. Then they came 100 megabit Ethernet. You know what the trick was? They just made it smaller and smaller. Okay, each hop was with the 10 megabit Ethernet, you go 500 meters. And then with the 100 megabit Ethernet, you could go only 100 meters. But still, you could architect around that because most of your closets were within 100 meters. And with gigabit Ethernet, I mean, the way it works is you have either better wires, like category 6 type of twisted pairs, which are highly noise resistant, or you just replace that wire and throw a fiber in there. And instead of sharing it, you go to a switched architecture from shared architectures. And then the end point of switching is just you have point-to-point architectures. So in gigabit Ethernet, it's all point-to-point. So I mean, this is the simplicity of networking. So in terms of last mile, what is happening is that the fiber is coming closer. That is, a large bandwidth pipe is coming closer and closer to the home. And then from there, you are having this legacy infrastructure. It's either the copper last loop, the local loop, or it's the twist or these coaxial cables. And even that, you are throwing all this fancy digital signal processing to it, and you're expanding the bands, etc. So that's how you're able to get more and more bandwidth over time. Okay, but the reason it's not happening instantly is because the whole thing is expensive to roll out, and it's only offered as incremental upgrades to particular areas as you're demonstrating a willingness to pay for this. And more importantly, there's not much competition in the last mile. Okay, there were more competitors, and in fact, in RPI, we are looking at wireless technologies for the last mile and broadband wireless technologies to give you gigabits to your home, right? So for the same price. So that is those are the technologies which are happening today, and in more of the research prototype stages and so on. Okay, so this is what is the nice thing about cable. Okay, so the aspect of broadcast makes it difficult to offer switched services. Okay, when you say a switch service, right, a switch ultimately gives you either a connectivity paradigm, okay, end-to-end, or connectivity abstraction, or that connectivity could be almost like a circuit or a virtual circuit. So that when you say a switched service, we usually refer to a virtual circuit or some form of connectivity end-to-end. And since the cable network is a broadcast architecture, or it was designed for broadcast, it makes it harder to offer switch services. So let me give you an example of switch service. A simple switch service is I want a movie on demand. Okay, so I want the cable operator to have 12,000 movies. Okay, and I want at any point in time to be able to get whatever movie I want, which means I want to get one channel to this this movie store and get my movie downloaded on demand. Okay, but this is not possible today. But through the expanding bandwidth available and through efficient multiplexing technologies, either over time, over space, etc., we are also starting to get that type of paradigm. Okay, but once you have switch networks like DSL, and so on and so forth, I mean, those have a separate line to you, so they can offer video services. But it turns out that video over DSL is still facing a lot of stumbling blocks because of the last mile loop is, and so on. We'll study that more carefully when you do DSL. Okay, so we saw this. So what is happening to cable is just like what is happening to telephony. Fiber optics is invading cable telephony. Okay, cable. So what has happened is fiber optics is coming closer and closer to the home. Okay, and the reason fiber optics took a long time to invade the cable space is that cable essentially uses analog modulation. Okay, in the telephony world, when they adopted fiber optics, there was a wholesale shift from analog modulation to digital modulation. So the people moved from FDM to TDM. Okay, or to from a frequency division to time division, but whereas in they couldn't afford to do TDM on cable networks. The reason is that you have all these channels which are multiplexed and they're all analog modulated separately, right? And you want just an abstraction of a single pipe that can carry. And to do analog modulation in optics turned out to be a difficult problem for quite a while. And only in the only after considerable advances in fiber optics being deployed in the telephone network did they figure out optoelectronic components to do analog modulation. Okay, and if you're more interested in fiber optics and optoelectronics, you should stake. There are courses offered at RPI, both on fiber optic technology as well as optoelectronics. Okay, so those are intensive courses going through all the way down to the physics of how things work out. Okay, so especially if you want to work in this area, you should take those courses. Anyway, so fiber optics, the one key difference, even though both of these were fiber optics, you required analog modulation in this broadband. Essentially, it is easy to turn light on and off and do simple intensity modulation. But if you want to do, you want to have make the light go at any arbitrary level, which is what analog is supposed to do, it is harder. Okay, so the equipment for that came later. But once you started having that, the photodetector technology or the receiver technology was fairly simple. And then you had these hybrid optical RF boxes which sat at the head ends. And and this head end notion itself will start moving closer and closer to the home. So there are these, what is this plant is known as a feeder plant, and you replace this coax from the feeder and throw a fiber in there, and with this sort of technology. Okay. So so what happens is such a network is known as a hybrid fiber coax network. Okay. We'll study all these things in great detail later, but essentially the very simple idea is that you have an optical head end here. And then you dump a fiber up here, and then it goes to an intermediate node known as an optical node, which is both optical and RF, and then you have the same old thing. Okay, the reason the whole thing is viable is that you can do this more and more, and fiber penetrates closer and closer. All this is nice in theory, but it takes a long time, over tens of years, to come closer and closer to your home. I mean, and one logical endpoint is that the fiber will come all the way up to the curb. Okay, and then you'll have just a very short cable run to your home. Okay, that is the cable view of the world. Okay. Anyway, so one of the reasons the whole thing became interesting is because you, since the cable operators had control over the content as well as the conduit, they could offer multiple services over the same infrastructure. Okay, in other words, this is like operating multiple virtual networks on top of the same physical network. So you would offer MPEG video to some subscribers. You would offer some switch data or cable modem service to some subscribers and the usual analog video the other subscribers and so on. So all these fancy service bundling capabilities would sit in these head-end boxes. Okay. Okay. So the future potential of HFC broadband is quite high. Okay, and that explains why AT&T recently actually went and bought almost $100 billion worth of cable assets. Okay, and then threw them away. Okay. So that's a separate story, but it's. Similarly, like big investors like Paul Allen from was formerly from Microsoft founder, he's invested a lot in cable assets, looking at this sort of trends. Okay, and the poster child of this trend is exactly this. Cable has a lot more bandwidth. It has a private conduit to your home, and through upgrades you can push fibers close and closer to this home, and you can start building this two-way technology, and through sophisticated digital signal processing bet on Moore's law. And sophisticated signal processing technology to overcome noise and interference problems, sophisticated multi-user detection technology, etc. So then, I mean, even as you come closer and closer, you can expect more than 200 megabits per second interactive. Okay, and this is still true in theory. Okay, so it's not, and even trial.